Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. This podcast is about immigrant entrepreneurs, and we have had more than 60 of them in the past episode. They all have been able to do what they did, like start their businesses legally in a country different from their citizenship, because of people like our guest today. Our today's guest is an attorney who specializes in immigration. He is Jason Finkelman. Jason, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Rohit. I'm honored to be a guest on your show.
I have to thank you to start with for helping all the entrepreneurs out there so far. And how long have you been doing this for?
Thank you so much for saying that. It's a pleasure. It's an honor. It's what I love to do in my practice. I've been practicing immigration law for over 10 years. Began my practice in Miami, Florida, and then moved it out about 7 years ago to Austin, Texas, where I'm based. But I have clients all over the United States, all over California and New York and Florida, all over. And mostly my practice is focused on working with international entrepreneurs and startups, helping them get the visas to come here and work and or live here permanently. And I do family-based immigration and all sorts of stuff, helping bringing the best, brightest talent to the United States.
Yeah. So immigration is very broad, right? But I have a feeling that based on your profile and where I've seen you talk, you are more interested or more focused on helping entrepreneurs more than other types of immigrants. Is that right?
Yeah, that's sort of the focus of my practice. It's something that I find very rewarding, especially when you see international businesses that are doing well and can succeed here in the U.S. and then, in fact, do succeed here in the U.S. based on, in part, on those individuals getting visas to come here to work. And also, you know, students and all types of other people who are here temporarily internationally, helping them grow their businesses and sort of live the American dream is something I'm very passionate about. I take a lot of pride in. I come from a family of immigrants. So I know how hard people work to get to where they want to be in life. And so when I'm able to help facilitate that, it's a very rewarding job.
Who is an immigrant in your family?
My father is from Cuba, born and raised.
Oh, I see. And he moved, and you were born in the U.S.?
I was born in the U.S., but he was born in Cuba, and he actually spent some time in Canada. So actually, I have dual nationality. I have American citizenship and Canadian citizenship by my father. But he was born in Cuba and really, truly lived the American dream as an immigrant and instilled those values in me and now what I do as an immigration attorney.
So when you were a kid, would you often visit Cuba and see the people, how they live there? And did that happen?
I have never been to Cuba, actually.
Oh, you haven't? Okay.
Only up until recently has it been easier for people to visit Cuba. I would love to one day get to visit Cuba, but I have not had the opportunity yet to go visit.
Okay, it's a beautiful place. You should go and have some cigars there.
Cigars and rum.
Yes, and get me one when you go. So let's dig into the content of what we want to talk here. But before we do that, so based on this podcast episode, can someone say that they can apply for their own visas without consulting an attorney? Or what would you say the advice we are giving about?
Anyone can apply for any type of immigration benefit by themselves and don't need attorney. However, like I said, to most people, you wouldn't try to do a surgery by yourself. You would hire a doctor to do that. As I say to most of my clients, whatever immigration benefit you're seeking, the immigration laws, you have one chance to do the job right. If you're denied for any reason on any visa that you apply for, it's very, very hard in the future to ever obtain another immigration benefit because you'll always have to disclose that you were denied previously, and that officer is going to sort of zoom in on that. So I always tell people it's best to hire an immigration attorney. At a minimum, call an immigration attorney to have a consultation, get some advice. It's better than what you're going to find on the internet, which is rife with incorrect information. And get some solid advice because it's your future and you want to make sure you do it right. So
And today we try to give you accurate information, not incorrect information.
Exactly,
but however, this cannot be.
Exactly. Yeah, that's sort of what the purpose of this is and why I enjoy. I speak across the country to people about this to sort of break down the complex immigration laws. And hopefully your listeners will be able to understand a bit better the immigration visa options, whether that's temporarily or permanent here in the U.S. So they have a better understanding of how the system works.
Yeah. So, however, what we talk today is only informational purposes and you need an attorney for legal advice. And today we are going to talk about three things. One is the new proposals for entrepreneur visas, very exciting stuff. We are going to talk about that. And then we'll move on to entrepreneur visas, E1, E2, L1A and such. And then we'll finally talk about the extraordinary ability visas. So these are only a subset of all the visas available out there. And there are more than 15, 20 visas and covering all of them was not an option. So let's start with the first one. So exciting times for entrepreneurs. So what were the new proposals that were suggested?
Sure. Yeah. So at the end of September, the White House came out with a proposed rule, emphasis on proposed, meaning as of today, which is October 12th, 2016. This is not yet currently the law. This is still just a proposal. Mm-hmm. The White House said, hey, you know, let's get a rule in place that we could help benefit international entrepreneurs. Well, it takes an act of Congress to create a new visa category for international entrepreneurs. So the White House said, look, we can, in using our authority, provide certain international entrepreneurs that qualify with something called parole. Parole is not a visa. Parole is not status in the U.S. Parole is really simply a piece of paper that an immigration officer would give to an international entrepreneur that qualifies that would allow them to temporarily work in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We'll come back and we'll talk about why this is important, that it's not a visa, it's not a status, and it's only a parole. And again, parole is just meaning the piece of paper you would get to work. But the qualifications proposed right now for this entrepreneur rule are that certain individuals would get a 2-year parole term, basically 2 years of work authorization in the U.S. If they can prove that they've established a new entity in the U.S. within the last 3 years, that the international entrepreneur, the applicant, has at least 15% ownership interest and has an active and central role in the operation and growth of their company, which means no passive investors. Mm-hmm. And the company can show what's called potential for rapid growth and job creation by either A, receiving $345,000 or more investment from a qualified U.S. investor, and we'll talk about what a qualified U.S. investor is in a second, or receiving $100,000 or more from a government business development or a similar grant. So if you meet those requirements, you would get 2 years of a parole, which would allow you to work for your startup in the U.S. Now, the qualified investor, having that $345,000 from a qualified investor, is someone – well, so backing up for a second. It's not the international entrepreneur, you. It's not your family member who's giving you that money. It's someone, an investor, who can prove that he or she has made monetary investments in a startup entity in exchange for equity in at least 3 separate calendar years, totaling no less than $1 million, and at least 2 of the investment entities, the startups, have generated at least $100,000 in revenue or at least 5 full-time jobs.
Okay, so even the investor needs to be qualified in some way.
Exactly, and that's a bit of a challenge if you're an international entrepreneur to go ask someone, hey, can you provide me with this evidence that, you know, you've gotten a investment in an entity in exchange for equity in 3 calendar years. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
That said, if you qualify for that, you would get 2 years of parole.
Yeah. But before we you tell more about why is parole different from visas, I'm curious to know that in the last 5-10 years that I've been following immigration law in the U.S., there have been many proposals, right? There were proposals for changing the entrepreneur visa limit from whatever 200K down to 20K, 30K, the number of job requirements to lower. and none of them passed in the past. So why is there more enthusiasm around this law as compared to the ones that were proposed and not passed in the past?
Great question. I don't know that there's much enthusiasm through all of Congress. I personally think that this is an enthusiasm from a president, a current president, mm-hmm. who says, look, I can't make visas for these people, which was what you were talking about before. There was some talk about let's pass some immigration reform to get legislation to create visa categories for international entrepreneurs. I think the current president is saying, look, in my limited power within immigration law right now, this is what I can offer. And I want to do that because I think international entrepreneurs are the future of our country. They're the bedrock that this country was founded on. Mm-hmm. And to the extent I can do anything to get these highly intelligent, hardworking entrepreneurs in this country, this is what I can offer.
So the payroll requires less approvals than a new visa category?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Having this new visa, having this payroll needs lesser of a, only if president approves it will go through and it doesn't need.
Exactly. Okay, exactly. It's kind of like an executive action. It's kind of like the president saying, here's what I can do, offer this parole. And it's in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security also wants to be able to give international individuals, entrepreneurs, the ability to come here and grow their businesses because it just makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, got it. And for visa classes, Congress needs to approve, and that may not happen. And that's why there is more enthusiasm. Now that makes sense because there is more likelihood of this going through than the proposals that came in the past.
Exactly, exactly. And the White House has said they hope that this initiative does become law by the end of 2016. So we'll keep our fingers crossed, keep posted on the news, and hopefully that's the case.
How is payroll different from a visa?
So parole is very, very different from a visa because it does not give you status in the U.S. Sort of playing the movie, when an international individual goes through the airport, enters at the airport and says, to that officer, or the officer says to them, what's the purpose of your visit? And they show the visa, and the purpose is I'm coming to work for this company and bring it in. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, parole is up to that officer if you meet this criteria to get this piece of paper to come here to work in the U.S. The big issue with this is, and I can talk about the second part of it, is initially you would get 2 years. There's other qualifications that you would get for a 3-year extension thereafter for a maximum of 5 years of parole. Mm-hmm. But what happens afterwards? You don't have status. This parole doesn't allow you to move into one of the other visa categories, which we'll talk about a little bit later in this podcast. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't allow you to adjust to lawful permanent residence here in the U.S. So what happens at the end of 2 or 3 years is essentially that international entrepreneur is going, I've built this business. I guess I've got to go home. When they go home, yes, they can apply for one of the visas we'll talk about at the foreign consulate, or they can apply for lawful permanent residence or a green card at the foreign consulate, but that can take a long time. And there's no path in this entrepreneur rule to getting into a visa status while you're here in the U.S., nor is there a path to becoming a lawful permanent resident as an entrepreneur in parole while you're here in the U.S. So that's one of the, I think, negative aspects of this. And something that
is it good to enter the country?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
So if I'm in, let's say, India and I qualified and I get this parole and I can take my flight and enter the US on this parole?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you qualify for this, you would get that parole. It's essentially a piece of paper, not a visa in your passport.
But I don't have to, I don't have to go to the consulate, US consulate even to get my visa stamping on my passport.
Well, there's no visa here.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So I just get this paper mailed to my Indian business office, and I take that paper, take my flight, and come to the U.S.
If you qualify, exactly. Yeah. And that would allow you to work.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Yeah. I've never seen that.
Yeah. Before. That's why it's very, very different from a visa. It really is. It's a piece of paper called parole. Okay. And that's going to allow you to work. Now, you would come here and you would get probably be able to apply for what's called an employment authorization document, an EAD card. But that's the qualifications for this are most important. I want to just touch briefly for a second on the extension components of this, because you would get 2 years initially, which we talked about. Mm-hmm. Then you, if you still qualify, you can get a 3-year parole thereafter. If you can show you still own 10% of the U.S. operations and you're running the operations, and you would have to show that either A, you've received at least $500,000 in additional funding. This is after the $345,000 we talked about before. Generated at least $500,000 in annual revenue with an average annualized revenue growth of at least 20% during the 2-year parole period previously. Or created at least 10 full-time jobs for U.S. workers during that previous 2-year parole period. So those are, it's not easy.
Yeah.
The White House actually said when they made this proposed rule that they guess about 3,000 people might actually, in reality, be qualified for this entrepreneur parole. And people who, your listeners who want to stay on top of this, I try to do that for my clients to say, visit my website, my Facebook page, my Twitter page. It's FinkelmanLaw.com Finkelmanlaw.com. Mm-hmm. You can look that up on Twitter, Facebook, and I post all recent news for anything we're talking about. So people are up to date on what's going on.
Great. Let's move on to the next one. Entrepreneur visas.
Absolutely. So there's a variety of visas that apply to international entrepreneurs. They're not actually entrepreneur visas, but they are used most commonly by international entrepreneurs. The first category we'll sort of briefly talk about, and the one that's most commonly used by international entrepreneurs, is the L1A visa. Mm-hmm. The L1A visa is for intra-company transferees. It's for international individuals who have worked for one out of the last 3 years for a company outside of the U.S., can be anywhere, doesn't have to be your home country, mm-hmm. in an executive or managerial capacity. And now that foreign entity either creates or already has established a U.S. entity that's related to the foreign entity via parent subsidiary, affiliate, branch. Mm-hmm. And that foreign entity is transferring the international individual to the U.S. to also work in an executive or managerial capacity. And we can
when you say executive or managerial, it doesn't say anything about ownership.
Right. So it's not necessarily executive or managerial doesn't refer to the title. Executive or managerial refers to the job functions you perform. So whether you call yourself the owner, CEO, general manager, doesn't really matter. It's whether you're performing the functions of an executive or manager.
Yeah. Got it. So I can be, if it's my own company in India, let's say, and I'm performing I'm the CEO. It's not the ownership portion of my relationship with the company that allows me to come here. It's the fact that I'm performing the CEO role that lets me qualify for this visa. Okay.
Now, so long as your foreign entity has a corporate relationship with the U.S. entity, then you can essentially transfer yourself as CEO, owner, general manager of your foreign entity and now create a U.S. entity that's related either via parent, subsidiary, or affiliate branch, and transfer yourself to the new U.S. entity to run that entity. That's most commonly how international entrepreneurs are doing that. So if you have your own business, you've worked for it for one out of the last 3 years abroad in an executive or managerial capacity, and now you say, I want to create a new U.S. entity, doesn't exist yet. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, says, look, we'll offer to international entrepreneurs something called the New Office L1A, which is to say, look, we realize you don't yet have a U.S. entity. You've created one. It's in existence. You have a bank account. You have a lease for an office. You've created those things. Now you want to transfer yourself to this new office and you want to actually start running this new U.S. business. Mm-hmm. What we can do if you qualify, you meet the qualifications of the L1A, is give you a 1-year L1A visa. In that time, if you're able to show that you've grown your business, hired employees, you've done something to grow your business, we can extend that visa up to 7 years to allow you to temporarily work for your U.S. company here.
I see. So I didn't know about this new L1A rule. That can come very handy for someone who doesn't have a U.S. presence yet.
Extremely handy. I would say the bulk of international entrepreneurs that I work with right now are doing that. Because if you think about it, you've got some company in Canada, Mexico, India, China, you're making widgets. You think those widgets can be successful here in the U.S.? Well, mm-hmm. You got to come here and set it up. Come here, create this U.S. business, get a business plan, show that it has the chance to succeed. Yeah. And USCIS will grant you that 1 year L1A visa. It's a very, very versatile visa. Uh-huh. It's also a dual intent visa. So typically most non-immigrant visas that we're going to talk about now allow you to temporarily stay in the U.S., but you must always exhibit an intent to return back to your home country every time you enter the U.S. What's nice about the L1A visa, it's a dual intent visa, which is to say, if during that 7 year time period, you start to make plans to be here permanently, the officers at the airport cannot deny you reentry into the U.S. on your L1A visa, mm-hmm. although you're clearly establishing intent to be here permanently, they must let you in because it's a dual intent visa, whereas some of the other visa categories we'll talk about do not have that dual intent, which means you cannot actively take steps to be here permanently in the U.S.
One of the things about L1 is also, I hear, is that right now H1s are oversubscribed, like 3:1, right? And there is a cap on H1. There is only 75,000. How many are available, Jason? You might know this better.
There is no cap on the L1A,
yeah,
which is terrific. And you can apply at any time. As many of your listeners know, there's an 85,000 cap on the H1B. You can only apply on April 1st. If you get it, you can only begin working on October 1st. That is not the case with the L1A. The L1A allows you to apply at any time, and there's no cap on the visas they can issue.
How about the spouse of L1 holder?
Great question. The spouse of an L1A holder would get an L2 visa. Mm-hmm. And when the spouse gets that L2 visa, they can enter the U.S. and apply for work authorization. Mm-hmm. That allows them to essentially go work wherever they want. They would apply for an EAD, employment authorization document, mm-hmm. and they would be able to get it for the same time as their spouse has their L1A for, and can work wherever they want here in the U.S.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yep. Spouses are usually feel stuck on H1, right? Right now with the new EAD rule, it may be better, but still it requires someone to apply for an I-140 and so on. On a lighter note, I know an entrepreneur who moved to the U.S. on a, his business is virtual, right? He doesn't have a physical office, but the L1 law requires him to have a physical office. So he had to sign a lease, cancel it,
right,
and so on, just to be able to get a visa. But hey, he succeeded eventually.
And that's extremely important. You know, I have to have a very realistic or a real conversation with my clients when I talk about the L1A. And I explain it like this. Look, the U.S. immigration laws were last written in our country sometime in the 90s. They didn't take into consideration the tech revolution or that we'd have virtual offices or co-working spaces or people would be able to. So the laws are old fashioned and they require individuals to get physical offices, to hire employees, to have bank accounts, to pay all these things. It's very inflexible in that way.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next one. E2 visa.
Sure. The E2 visa is for foreign nationals who are coming to the U.S. from certain countries that have a treaty with the U.S., and we'll talk about that in a second, to make a, quote, substantial investment in a U.S. entity that they are then going to run. So the first criteria for the E2 is that it only applies to nationals of certain countries that have a treaty with the U.S. So here's where I sort of get to burst the bubble for some people. Certain countries that do not have this treaty and therefore are not eligible to apply for the E2, the U.S., are India, China, Brazil, Russia, Israel, whole host of other countries. And you can go online and look up E2 eligible countries and see whether or not you qualify. If you do, the issue is then you coming to make a substantial investment in a U.S. entity. The question then is, Jason, what's a substantial investment? The answer is, it all depends on what the entity is you're coming to run. If you're coming to run, let's say, a small food truck, probably a lower investment in relation to the entity. On the other hand, if you're coming to run a semiconductor fabrication facility, probably much higher in relation to the entity. That said, in my real experience as an immigration attorney practicing, I see the trend, at least over the last 18, 24 months, to be about $100,000. The client comes to me with saying, I want to make an investment regardless of the business, and they want to invest, you know, $50,000 or $40,000. I have to look them in the eye and say, you can try, but I don't think USCIS will deem that to be a substantial investment. Mm-hmm. They consider $100,000 to be about normal for getting the office, getting your chairs, your desk, your computer, hiring employees, paying your taxes, doing all those things. So that's typically what I say. That's not a hard and fast number. Mm-hmm. You know, if you came in a little less, okay, maybe, but that's a rough estimate of what I tell people.
It's more of a best practice rather than a hard rule.
Yeah, that's it. The E2 visa is nice because there is no, there's no cap on it, so you can apply at any time, and there's no actual length of period in which it expires. Technically, you can renew the E2 visa indefinitely. However, you must always show non-immigrant intent. So this visa is not a dual intent visa, which means you would not be able to start to make plans to be here permanently in the U.S. while in E2 status. Mm-hmm. Because the officer at the airport would say, hey, this is a non-immigrant visa. You must always exhibit an intent to return back to your home country. I see here you are making plans to be here permanently. Sorry, deny, go home. You can get a green card and you can apply for lawful permanent residence, but you would have to do it in your home country at the consulate.
Got it. And what are the options for someone who's already in E2 visas to transition to permanent residency?
We can talk about those under the different EB1, EB2, EB3 okay. categories, but the individual would have to do that at their home country and process that there.
Got it. Okay, so is there anything else about E2 that you'd like to add, or can we move on to the next one?
Let's move on to the next one.
Okay, EB5. Let's do this quick, Jason. EB5, what is EB5?
Sure. EB5 quickly is somewhat known in slang as the $1 million investor visa. The EB5 is an option for international investors who currently, as of today, want to invest either $1 million into a business that they are going to run, and that business will then create jobs for 10 U.S. workers. And the government stepped in, and this program has been around for several decades. The government stepped in and said, look, if you invest $500,000 into a business in a targeted employment area that's got sort of issues with parts of town where things aren't growing, so we'll take the money and put it into a railroad system or a hospital or something that can be there. We'll pool the money at $500,000 from international investors and put it into this entity, and that will also create jobs for 10 U.S. workers. The short end of this is individuals have to keep the money there for many, many years. It's a straight shot to a permanent residency, to a green card. Initially, you would get a conditional permanent resident card and then could apply for just a regular permanent resident card.
What do you
card.
Mean by many years? Like 10 years, 20
I
years?
I would say about 5 years. So 5 years, okay. Generally, it's about 5 years that your investment has to be there and show that the 10 jobs for U.S. workers are there. Now, what happens is if you take $1 million, everyone goes, great, I'll put $1 million and I'll put it into some building downtown. And great. Well, that's very, very risky, because if the economy takes a dive and your money's gone and you don't have $1 million there, or the project stops, not only do you lose your money, but you also lose that green card. On the other hand, $500,000 historically tends to be a little safer investment, because the government has an interest in ensuring that the hospital continues to get built or the government building continues to get built. Really quickly, this program is currently, I think the first or second week of December of this year, Congress is set to reauthorize this program, and we anticipate the amount of $1,500,000 to increase. We don't know. We're guessing maybe to about $1.2 million, maybe $800,000 increase in those.
Yeah, the government's program seems interesting for someone who has the money. One of my friend applied for this class of visa, and he went through the government program. The only complaint he had about this program was he had to prove where the money was coming from. So he had to go as far as 1960s and provide documentation from the 60s from his grandparents to show that it was all legal money.
If your listeners want to get a visual for what that means, and that's actually one of the biggest challenges in the EB-5 is showing what's called the lawful source of funds, which means, okay, I'm going to invest $1 million or $500,000. You have to show the source of every single dollar of that amount. Well, very easy if you've earned $1 million and you have tax returns and you can prove that, great. However, if you're borrowing $100,000 from your uncle who sold some property and then $200,000 from grandma as a gift, all these people have to show their funds. There's a great image if people want to go either to my Facebook page or to Twitter of, I do EB-5 visas a lot, of an EB-5 I just did for an Indian national, and I kid you not, it was over 3 feet of paperwork, over 75 pounds of paperwork for one person. So these can get very complex very quickly. Mm-hmm. However, they're done all the time, and I do them a lot, and they're a great way to permanent residency if you have that money.
Yeah, 3 feet of paperwork. That's funny. Let's move on to the next one, Jason. The next one we have is Extraordinary Ability Class of Visas. The reason I bring this up is recently I'm seeing a lot of people apply for this class of visas, which was not exploited or explored as much in the past, maybe 5 years ago even. So I think that this, with all the new regulations and all the caps getting filled up, more people are seeking extraordinary ability, and not many people know about them yet. Do you see it that way also in the market?
In some cases, yes. I think you're absolutely right. The most common visa people are hearing about in this extraordinary ability class of visas right now is the O-1. And the O-1 typically is known as the rockstar visa. The reason why is the O-1 really is reserved for aliens of extraordinary ability. And the law actually says, and the O-1, they cite examples of people who might be eligible for this O-1 visa. And in the law itself, the examples are people like gold medal winners and Nobel Prize winners, mm-hmm. Academy Award winners, very famous people. Well, over time, it seemed that that was a category that was only going to be reserved for, you know, several hundred people in the world.
Yeah.
And the law became more flexible to allow people to prove with a number of different criteria that they truly were extraordinary. And we'll talk about that. But it's now an option, at least that I talk about with my clients, to say, hey, no, if you think about it, and we'll examine the criteria, you really are extraordinary. You really are someone who has reached the top of their field.
When you say law has become flexible recently, is it that the law has changed, or is it that the authorities are being more flexible about how the law is used?
The law hasn't changed. The law hasn't itself. I think the officers looking at these are, again, working with a good attorney who can be persuasive and can be creative, can prove with these 10 different criteria that an alien truly is extraordinary. So I think the officers now are able to say, okay, yeah, there is an argument to be made here that this alien isn't extraordinary. Maybe they haven't won a Nobel Prize. Maybe they aren't a gold medalist. But according to the criteria in this, they really are extraordinary.
Let's talk about that criteria. What are the criteria?
Yeah, so under the EB-1, applicants have to show that they've met 3 out of 10 criteria to prove extraordinary ability. And your listeners can go and Google the actual criteria. I don't want to recite them all, but those things are, you know, winning of awards, membership in certain esteemed groups or organizations, published material in major publications, The international individual has been a judge of foreign work. They've written certain scholarly articles. They've showcased or exhibited their work at international or nationally renowned places. They can show sort of a commercial success. There's a whole list of those things. If you can show 3 out of 10 of those criteria, obviously the more of each of those categories, the better, you may be eligible for the O-1.
I see. Yeah, I was trying to Google for the list of extraordinary abilities. Yeah, there are 10 of them. I'll try to include that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, please. Yeah, I don't want to just recite them all, but they're very easy to find online. But the general gist of it are those that I've already said. And if you can show, hey, I was published, my work was published in a major newspaper here in my country, which is read by lots of people, or mm-hmm. I have a scholarly article that was published in a peer-reviewed journal of science or medicine or business or art, those types of things, you can show many of
them. Yeah, for your publications, right?
Yeah.
Does it have to be in the US, or can it be anywhere internationally?
It can be anywhere internationally. It's just showing that the publication was in either a peer-reviewed journal, which means yeah. it's reviewed, or a journal that's published widely. Oftentimes I get students who come to me and said, yeah, I was published about my work in my student newspaper. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, well, you know, your student newspaper is nice, but it's not like it was published in the New York Times or the Austin American Statesman or whatever major journal that you can say, ah, look, thousands of people read this newspaper or thousands of people read this journal. Therefore, I think it's pretty extraordinary.
Got it. It's also an non-immigrant or dual intent visa. What type
exactly.
of visa is this?
So the O-1 is similar to the other visa categories we talked about before. It's a dual intent visa, which means you can be, well, let me back up for a second. The O-1 does not have any caps on it, so mm-hmm. you can apply at any time. The O-1 can also be renewed indefinitely. There's no time period, max time period, so long as you can show that you have an intent to return back to your home country. But what's nice about the O-1 is you can also show that it's a dual intent visa, so you can come here and work and try to go on the lawful permanent resident path if that's something that interests you. But again, it's a temporary visa, and it requires a U.S. employer to sponsor you. So that's one of the other issues. It does not allow for self-sponsorship. Whereas the L-1, you could talk about self-sponsorship. E-2, you could kind of talk about self-sponsorship, even though it's the company. The O-1 requires that a U.S. company or U.S. person sponsors you for this visa.
I see. I've heard of artists applying for O-1 visas. How does artists apply if a company needs to sponsor?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So many of the musicians that people see here, the international musicians that are coming to play here in the U.S. are on O-1 visas. International actors, actresses, athletes come on this O-1 visa as well. So what happens is their sponsor, their U.S. sponsor, in the case of a musician, is actually the venues, the U.S. venues that are paying them to play. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of an actor or actress, it's the U.S. production company or film studio that's paying them. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of an athlete, the U.S. team that's paying them. So that's where the sponsorship comes in. But if you're an international musician or actor or athlete, this is a great option for you to come in and perform.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I was just asking that out of curiosity. I don't think any international musicians are listening to this show.
Right? You'd be surprised. Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
I hope so. Yeah. So you talked briefly about lawful permanent residency starting with O-1, which also brings us to the next class of next category, which is the EB-1.
Yeah, so we're moving now from the non-immigrant temporary work visas here in the U.S., to the what's called lawful permanent resident, the employment-based lawful permanent resident, which is the same thing as green card process. And there are certain categories which people can apply for lawful permanent residents, EB-1, EB-2, EB-3, and so on. The certain categories require the foreign national to have a U.S. employer that's going to sponsor them, and then that U.S. employer has to do a test of the U.S. labor market to show that there are no qualified, able, willing, or available U.S. workers who can do what that international person does before they bring in and sponsor that international person for permanent residency. It's a way to protect the American workers. Mm-hmm. However, under the EB1 category, it's a category that's reserved for several classes of individuals that don't have to go and do this test of the U.S. labor market. Those are immigrants with extraordinary abilities in their particular field, outstanding researchers and professors, and managers and executives. Again, under that EB1 category for immigrants with extraordinary abilities, you would have to show 3 out of the 10 criteria. And it's, again, I say to most people, it's a little bit harder than that O1 because the benefit is sweeter in the end, which is lawful permanent residence. But you really have to show you are internationally recognized as sort of top of your field by showing 3 out of the 10 criteria, which you can Google online, awards, publications, articles written about you, so on and so forth.
But the criteria itself is same for O1 and EB1. Is that right?
It's similar, but the way I describe it to most people is it's more rigorous.
I see. So the way it is looked at is more rigorous. So the officer who's looking at EB1 is trying to be more stringent about how the law is read, more than the officer.
I would say so. And the reason why is because the benefit is significantly sweeter.
Yeah.
You know, than a temporary O1 visa. You're now asking for permanent residency in the U.S.
How about the employer requirement for EB1?
The EB1, you do not need an employer to a sponsor. You can actually sponsor yourself. Mm-hmm. That said, again, it is very, very difficult to show that you can qualify under these categories because not only is it, you know, the top category, you're showing you're an internationally recognized individual, but if you think about it, you're essentially saying to the USCIS officer, look, I want to qualify under this EB1 category by myself, without a U.S. sponsor, and without a test of the U.S. labor market. Mm-hmm. My skills, my abilities are so good that I can forego this test of the U.S. labor market that all these other international people have to go through, and you should grant this to me without that process. Yeah. Well, that officer is going to go, that's a very, very, very high standard.
Yeah.
And they're really looking for you to show not only extraordinary ability, but as I say to my clients, that it's extraordinary ability that will substantially benefit the country in its entirety, the United States. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very high standard, and not everyone can qualify.
And another thing that you're not doing here is spending money, right? You're not even bringing money into the U.S. market to help the economy in any way. So I'm guessing that also requires, because of that, that bar should be higher.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And if I have anyone who thinks they may be eligible for the EB1, I would say to them, well, hey, maybe you can actually prove that your benefit to the United States is in the economic best interest of the United States, you know, so that would help do it because exactly like you said, if you're not bringing anything here, you know, what's the big deal?
Got it. One thing I noticed recently in the October bulletin or September bulletin, I forget which month, is that even EB1 category started to have backlog.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be? Do you see that continuing to be the case, or do you think it's going to get better?
Yeah, so for your listeners, a bit of a background. Each of these categories has a bit of a backlog, depending upon your nationality, depending upon whether you qualify under EB1, EB2, EB3. Those times in which those backlogs change, which make you eligible to actually apply for lawful permanent residence, all have to do with the actual amount and quantity of immigrant visas, lawful permanent resident cards, that USCIS is able to issue. So they fluctuate wildly throughout the year. Because it's slow in month one doesn't necessarily mean that it is going to be the same way in month two. So there's really no crystal ball. None of us are able to predict that. It changes month to month. I know their fiscal year, Department of Homeland Security's fiscal year begins in October. Uh-huh. So I think you may have saw some advancement in October, and that's why it slowed down in September. But as I say to people, no one can predict how that's going to be, and it's sort of a guessing game. Changes every month.
I see. For EB1 itself, I haven't seen, or there hasn't been a backlog in years, for 5 years
or something.
And that was the first time that came up, which kind of panicked a few people.
Yeah, I think that has to do with just it being the end of the fiscal year. I think that's what our guess is, and that they were just anticipating to increase those the next month.
Great. So the last thing, let's do this quickly, Jason. So the within EB2, there is an exceptional ability, right? So what is that?
Exactly. So the generally the second preference category, EB2, covers immigrants with advanced education, such as a master's degree or a PhD, working in a position that requires that degree. What USCIS has done is said, look, if immigrants can demonstrate exceptional ability, they can also be included in the EB2 regardless of their degree. This EB2 does require a labor certification, though, does require an employer to sponsor you and go through this test of the U.S. labor market. But again, under this category, if you can show, I think it's 3 out of 6 criteria, that you are an alien of exceptional ability, you may be able to qualify under this without having a actual master's degree or PhD level degree.
I see. So that's a small little leeway within the existing EB2 category, which makes it easier for you.
It is, and it's also looked at very, very hard. I encourage your listeners to just Google the exceptional ability EB2 and look at the criteria on there. They're also hard. I mean, there's a lot of experience requirements, showing that you have license, showing that you're going to get a very high salary, membership in certain professional associations. It's quite difficult.
I see. So why would someone go for this instead of going for EB1 directly?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Why would someone go for EB2 with exceptional ability instead of going for EB1 directly?
It depends on whether you think you can meet the qualifications, the criteria of the EB2 under exceptional ability or under the extraordinary ability of EB1. Certain people can or cannot meet the criteria. Other people, it just depends on what your experience is. Every single immigration case is different. Every single person is unique. Just because person A got it under EB1 doesn't necessarily mean you're going to qualify under EB2.
Got it. I see now the difference. It's exceptional ability for EB2 versus extraordinary ability for EB1. And I also see your note in the notes that we were using to share with each other that exceptional ability for EB2 used to be easier than extraordinary for EB1, but now they have been interpreted by USCIS to be very similar.
I would say that's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Great. Jason, this has been very informative. For someone who wants to learn more or get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, people can reach me via my website, which is www.finkelmanlaw.com. That's spelled FinkelmanLaw.com. You can also Google Finkelman Law on Facebook, Finkelman Law on LinkedIn and Twitter. And I keep my clients up to date with news on all those mediums. And I encourage your listeners, if they have any question, to reach out to me directly. I know how hard, especially international entrepreneurs, work to be here in the U.S. and to create a better life for themselves. I'd rather them get honest, genuine advice from me or an attorney personally than guess and read messages that may not be correct on the internet.
Absolutely. I will leave links to your website and everything in the show notes as well. And I have to say, usually lawyers are not easy to get hold of, but you have been very approachable and very friendly, even on social platforms like Twitter and Facebook. So thanks for being available, I would say.
I genuinely appreciate that, Rohit, and I genuinely appreciate the work you do with this podcast, inviting me on, and I thank you for the service you do for everyone that's listening.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.